you can see that at some stage there is going to be a popping of the credit bubble. And I think that's not very far off. I think it could be. In fact, I'd be very surprised if it doesn't happen by this year end. We all think of anniversaries. We remember October 1987, for example. We remember October, well, at least our grandfathers, grandparents might remember.
Alistair MacLeod, good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well.
Great to have you on. And what's that saying? May you live in interesting times. And that's certainly the case that we find ourselves in right now, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, let's talk about it. So tell me, my daughter, to set this up, my daughter came home. She was away working in Alaska, of all places. And she came home and she was just completely out of it. And she just asked me point blank, what's going on in the UK? And she showed me all of these the gatherings and protests and that were happening right in London. So give me your two cents of what's going on with the UK. I'll let you take it from there.
I mean, the riots are really to do with Palestine as much as anything. I mean, like many countries in Europe, we've got a very large Muslim population. And as far as they're concerned, the Israelis are committing genocide in Gaza. So there are very big protests. And of course, when you get protests of that sort, you get all sorts of people jumping on the bandwagon. So it's probably bigger than it should really be. Now, that said, I'm sure that this is part of the motivation for Britain recognizing Palestine as a nation, which of course America is not doing and refuses to do. So and the same is true in France. I mean, if you look at France, there is again, from their colonial occupation of Algeria, they have got a huge Muslim population, and that's not at all integrated into the wider population. So they've got that additional problem. Plus, of course, all the migrants that we've had after the seven wars in the Middle East. All American-led, I have to say, has meant a huge influx of Syrians, Afghanis, Iraqis, Libyans, and the whole thing. That is, I think, really what it's about. One thing we do not have, which they have in France, is street demonstrations, if you like, about the government's economic handling. I mean, there are, if you like, protests within Parliament. So within the system, you find that MPs will, protest, if you like, in the House of Commons, but in an orderly fashion. We're not talking about, sort of revolutionaries walking the streets and so on and so forth. I think that's probably what your daughter was referring to. But there is the wider problem. And that is that when Labour was elected a bit over a year, about a year ago, I suppose, a bit over a year ago, the first thing that they did was pursue their schoolboy socialism, soak the rich, hate the bourgeoisie, take down all their structures and all the rest of it. So Rachel Reeves went on that sort of campaign, and also backed by the unions, she raised wages for bureaucrats and also railway workers and doctors and and all the rest of it, which was quite simply unaffordable. It got to the stage really where the feedback going into the Treasury from the Inland Revenue, which is a department of the Treasury, was that the tax receipts are not coming in as forecast in the budget. Why? Well, Mr. Laffer will tell you why. basically, I mean, if you bear in mind that when she had that budget, roughly 10%, no, sorry, 30% of income tax receipts are paid by the top 1% of wage earners. I mean, so it's a very, very heavily skewed tax system. And those high earning individuals have just decided to decamp. They're all in Dubai or Milan, which very sensibly the Italians turned around and said, "Oh, we've got a chance here. We can get some more revenue by inviting these chaps in for a flat tax," which he's done. So we have actually lost a lot of revenue, and it got to the stage where it was absolutely clear the only thing which the government could do, which they should have done in the first place, is cut public spending. And they attempted to do that. That failed because the Parliamentary Labour Party threw the legislation out. And that left Rachel Reeves, sort of going, "Oh my God, oh, what have I done?" That moment. And she was actually weeping in Parliament as it wasn't actually in that particular debate, but that week during Prime Minister's questions when the issue was broached by the opposition. And now, of course, she's got another budget to consider. I mean, originally it was an autumn statement, if you like, but now it's turning into a budget. It's as simple as that. This has been postponed because obviously they can't balance the books. They can't make the decisions necessary. They're still floating ideas to see what the public reaction is. You've got think tanks, left-wing think tanks, saying, you've got to introduce a wealth tax, despite the fact that wealth taxes elsewhere have always ended up costing, because the wealthy just say, "Well, to hell with this, we're off." And furthermore, as the French have found, when they do away with the wealth tax, which was inadvisable in the first place, do you think the wealthy return? Do they hell is like once bitten, twice shy? They stay away. So it's actually, I mean, we've got to the stage where, and Laffer-Curve, we understand this, but the socialists deny it because it completely goes against their creed. So they've got problems, and I think one of the possible outcomes of this budget is that I can see things sliding really quite quickly. Just look at the price of gold, how that's shooting up. That is shooting up because currency's purchasing power is shooting down. It's a loss of faith, if you like, in fiat currencies. So there is an impending crisis, which I'm sure we'll discuss. I think that by delaying the autumn statement to the end of November, it was meant to be at the end of September, incidentally, I think there's a fair chance that the whole process will be overwhelmed by a global financial crisis. So, but that we'll wait and see. But there is no doubt that we've got problems. France has got the same problem, bigger
Yeah,
problem.
talk about that if you don't mind. And maybe it was France that she said the UK, but maybe she was looking at France. Do you see that kind of demonstration coming to the UK, if you would? And then also talk about France, which is just their government more or less imploded about 2 weeks ago. Correct me if I'm wrong. So work both of those things out for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, we don't take to the streets on tax issues. The French do. And
The French
Macron,
Revolution.
going back, yes. Actually, you're absolutely right. The history books, I think, don't fully understand what happened at the time of the French Revolution, because, of course, that was the time of the collapse of the dreaded assignat currency. When you get a collapse of currency, then of course people take to the streets. It was that, I reckon it was that more than anything that led to the storming of the Bastille and all that sort of the revolution that followed. But going back to the UK, we don't tend to go and walk the streets, if you like, and have banners about taxes and throw Molotov cocktails at the police or anything like that. We leave that to the supporters of the sort of Palestinians and the commies and all that sort of left-wing violent nasty stuff. But France is different. A big cause of riots has been pension reform, and Macron quite sensibly has tried to raise the retirement age from which pensions would apply. And is I mean, basically, his governments have fallen, what, twice on that issue alone. And I guess every time they fall, we're more likely to get Marie Le Pen's lot in, which, of course, all the social democrats say, shock, horror, this is terrible. In a sense, there is this wider problem, and that is that the old guard, which is the social democrat, the lot that basically believes in the state rather than private enterprise. They see private enterprise, if you like, as a source of revenue and something they don't actually understand. It satisfies their sort of quasi-communist views. They are now on the way out in exactly the same way as the Democrats were on the way out in America's recent presidential election. So you've got this sort of shift. And in Germany, it's a similar sort of thing. They're trying to keep the AfD out. The AfD is basically a conservative party. I would say very much on the lines in terms of intellectual approach as Charlie Kirk. I mean, nothing wrong with it at all. But of course, absolutely hated by the socialists who brand them fascists. This is a typical. This is what the socialists always do. Anything which they don't agree with, which is free market or whatever, they call fascist. They don't understand actually that the origin of fascism was communism itself. It's just creed. Mussolini lost out in the fight for the Italian Communist Party. I think it was about 1918, around about then, I think in the wake of the First World War. And so he founded a new communist party, which was fascist. It's basically it was the same sort of thing. So anyway, the point is that it's not just Britain and France, but also Germany. And interestingly, if you look at Germany's bond market, the 10-year yield is hitting new high ground. I mean, Germany was the, if you like, one of the world's manufacturing engines, let's put it that way, where the superior quality technology and all the rest of it, so good that it even survived a rising Deutschmark. But there is no doubt that from the point of view of German industry and the Mittelstand, that they would rather have a currency that wasn't rising all the time and making it even harder for them to really compete. So, okay, they supported the euro, but the euro is now doing them no good at all. We now have a complete loss of confidence. It's beginning anyway in Germany. Interestingly, another G7 member is Japan. Look at their bond market, and the yield there is again going into high, new high ground. I'm looking at the 10-year in particular. You go out longer, it's even worse. The UK is similarly finding bond yields persistently high and expensive in the, because we've got roughly 100% debt to GDP, government debt to GDP. And this is a huge cost on government. It really is. But it's going higher. And I have no doubt at all that, I mean, if you look at the long-term trends, there's no doubt at all that bond yields out along the yield curve are going to go considerably higher than they are now. And I experienced this back in the 1970s in the UK. We called in the IMF in 1976 on the back of the sterling crisis. And I can remember at that time there were three gilts being our government bond, three gilts issued with 15% coupon, 15.25% coupon, and 15.5% coupon.
Wow.
I remember well the 15.5s in 1998. Now,
How does an economy function with that high of interest?
well, you've asked a very good question, because in 1976, UK's debt to GDP was under half of where it is now. I mean, I think we were looking at something like 45%. Now we're 100%. These high rates are crucifying government finances. they will crucify US government finances where the debt to GDP is, what, 120%.
Right.
I mean, this what we're looking at is no less than the end of the fiat currency era. We just cannot survive it on fiat currencies. Fiat currencies will lose their purchasing power one way or the other. I mean, if the Fed, what the Fed has done in the last week, I'm sorry, I'm switching
No,
countries.
no problem.
What Fed did in the last week was it clearly told everybody, we're not chasing inflation, we're chasing, sorry, we're not trying to control inflation, we're trying to stimulate reflation
Yeah.
because, you know, because of jobs and all this. You know, I mean, this is quite important. And not only that, but the bets are something like 90% possibility that there will be two more cuts in interest rates before the year end. You know, this is the reflation argument coming forth. Now, that is going to weaken the dollar, that is for sure. And it'll weaken the dollar against gold, which is why gold is going up at the moment. I think in the short term, it will also weaken the dollar against other currencies. The jury's out slightly, but just look at the trade weighted index chart and you think, whoops, I don't think I'd want to own any of this. I think what would undermine the dollar is not so much, if you like, interest rate differentials with elsewhere, insofar as you know, you can get more for the equivalent sterling bond, or you know, I mean, you can't get more if you like, if you go into yen or if you go into euros. But there is a sort of balance in, of risk and return in these things. And but the way it's looking, I think, is the foreigners who are massively overweight in dollars. I mean, according to the US Treasury, they own $40 trillion, which is 130% of your economy. That, I think, is the fundamental weakness that the dollar faces compared with other currencies. At some stage, and I'm surprised it hasn't really happened yet, foreigners will start selling down their dollars, selling their underlying assets, because they've got deposits, they've got T-bills, they've got corporate debt, and they've got something like 16 trillion worth of equities. You know, this is portfolio diversification. Now, I know enough. My own experience of portfolio diversification into foreign markets, that is only portfolio diversification when they're going up. The moment they turn south, whoops, you don't want to diversify
You don't want to be, they come back home.
at all. So you can see that at some stage, there is going to be a popping of the credit bubble. And I think that's not very far off. I think it could be, in fact, I'd be very surprised if it doesn't happen by this year end. Yeah, you know, we all think of anniversaries. We remember October 1987, for example.
Yeah.
We remember October, well, at least our grandfathers, grandparents might remember October 1929. You know, it somehow it seems, I think the sort of psychology of it is that we all go on holiday in the summer, you know, it's with sort of putting everything on hold and, you know, thinking, well, got, you know, going out with children and beach holidays and, you know, oh, it's so nice out there. I'm just going to lie in the deck chair, whatever, whatever. And you don't think too much about markets. But when you get back, of course, you have quarterly committee meetings, investment committee meetings in all the big firms. They'll be sitting there and they'll be looking and seeing how they have performed. They see what they have missed, and they'll be looking at gold and mines, and they'll be looking at the Magnificent Seven, and they'll be looking at macro risk and trying to take a judgment on that. And I think on balance, that's why you suddenly get a vacuum underneath the market in the last quarter of the year, if it's going to happen. So this is, I think, a very dangerous time from that point of view. Now, let me just say something about the
Please.
credit bubble. We all know credit bubbles precede a collapse in markets. They fuel markets and then you get the collapse. Going back, you had tulipomania, you know, in Holland way back in the, well, I think, 1700s. You had the Mississippi bubble in France, which was actually very similar to this one insofar as it was a fiat currency under John Law, who basically stopped people having gold and silver and precious things. He confiscated them. And at the same time, you had the South Sea bubble in the UK. And this was all done on credit, incidentally. It was the beginning of the goldsmiths, sort of, if you like, invented modern British banking. At that time, they found people would deposit their gold with them, and before long, certificates, sort of evidencing gold being deposited at a reliable goldsmith was were changing hands in forms of, in form of payment. So it was the forerunner of checks. It was expansion of credit that did all this. So you get a credit expansion, and that fuels a market, and then you get the collapse. Now, in 1929, we had the Roaring Twenties credit expansion. But the other thing we had the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act right at the top of the market. It was dated 1930. It was originally examined by Congress in late 1929 or mid 29, and then passed to the upper house, which finally approved it. And it was signed into law by President Hoover in I think around about April 1930. So we had the combination of the popping of a credit bubble and the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. Now, what have we got today? We've got a far larger credit bubble,
We have
and
tariffs.
we have got. We don't know where we are with these damn tariffs. I mean, we know that we've got the damn things, but you've got a capricious president who keeps on changing his mind and threatening, whoever he doesn't like at that particular moment with 100% tariffs or whatever. This is very disruptive and not to be ignored. So we've got a very similar situation to 1929. I don't need to remind everybody that the stock market collapsed. It lost 90% of its value. 10,000 banks went out of business, which was actually why money supply contracted, because money supply contracts basically when credit is extinguished by
Right.
It led to the end of the old gold standard in 1933, 1934 rather. At 20.67, which persisted all the way since the mid 1800s, de facto, but de jure from the Gold Act in 1900. So that was major. This one is bigger. It is bigger than 1929, and we've got exactly the same thing. So,
I'm not laughing at you. I'm just laughing at the absurdity of it and the intensity of it and the size of it. It's just mind-blowing.
It is. But Andy, the thing is that when you're in a bubble like this, if you're a professional fund manager, you are managing other people's assets. And you get into trouble if you're not playing the game. They say,
Right.
look, the S&P's gone up 300% or whatever the figure is. And what have you done?
Right.
You've had me sitting in bonds which have gone down.
Right.
I sack you.
Yeah, I've
So
been in that seat, if you would. So, yeah.
exactly. So you have this self-perpetuating factor, if you like, in the bubble.
Yeah. So, a lot of great points there. I want to pull a little bit out more about the EU and currency wars here. Do you see the EU and the euro more or less going away over the next several years? Is this the beginning of the end, if you would, with that?
Yeah, I think I would sort of broaden it a bit and say we're, as I said earlier, this is the end of the fiat currency system. And the
Great
euro,
statement, by the way. It makes me think, but go ahead, go ahead.
and the euro is the poster child for the euro currency system. It
Right.
is an invention. It is a it's not just a fiat currency, but it's sort of it's been constructed on the basis that the past doesn't matter. And what I mean by that is that if you have a currency like sterling or even the old Deutsche Mark or whatever, it has a history. And it's sort of accepted by the people that use it on the basis of its history.
Right.
The euro started off literally in the year 2000. It's now been going for what, 25 years. Now, you might think that that's quite enough history, but actually, when push comes to shove, that I think is going to be tested. In any event, it's issued by a bank, a central bank, which is owned by all the other central banks. And I would say that it's quite important that the ECB actually is itself deeply in negative equity. Now, it's not alone in that. I mean, if it was a private corporation, the directors would be in jail.
Yeah,
Yeah. Now, it's something which doesn't matter until it matters. Let me put it that way. At some stage, the fact that the Fed, the Bank of Japan, not the Bank of England's all right, actually, because it passed on its liabilities, QE liabilities, to the UK Treasury, and it's actually all the gilts that it bought are contained in a special purpose vehicle, which is guaranteed by the UK Treasury. So, the Bank of England was actually quite sensible, and that was Lord King, who was a previous governor, who put that in place. But all the other central banks, they're deeply into negative equity. So let us assume now, and I think this is a very reasonable assumption, that the most major economies are stalling and likely to go into recession. Some of them are already definitely in recession. And if you're unkind enough to actually do the arithmetic on GDP and strip out budget deficits to leave a genuine reflection of private sector activity, private sectors in virtually all the major economies are in recession already. In other words, their GDP is contracting, if you like. So, and it's quite simple. If you get, let's say, nominal GDP is growing by 4% and the budget deficit is 6.5%, take away 6.5% from 4% and you're contracting 1.5%, 2.5%, whatever. That is the reality of what's happening. The idea that we've got any growth at all, I mean, the whole thing is a misnomer. Anyway, it's growth in credit, not quite how it's deployed, which is another factor which is too depressing to go into. But I think that we are already, if you like, going into recession. Now, what this does is it makes it even harder to sustain the increasing level of government debt, because government debt depends on the ability of the government to finance it. If it's got a high level of debt, if it requires yet more debt, and if the private sector is contracting, then the revenue base is contracting, and therefore debt becomes less affordable. This is reflected in the risk which debt holders, bondholders, will require compensation for in order to continue to hold or to buy new debt. And this is why yields are rising out along the yield curve. It's a reflection of debt traps, if you like. Ugly phrase. Doom loop is another one, if you like, doing the same thing. All major governments are in that position.
That's the thing is, and not to interrupt you, but that's the thing is like I don't see really the way out of this for all governments because of the level of debt that they have. They have to print. I mean, when I say have to print, they don't have to print, but theoretically they don't. But the reality is they do in order to get out of it, correct? And that's where your currency crisis comes in as well.
That's correct. I mean, governments have taken upon themselves not only to be the lenders of last resort to the banking system, to underwrite the banking system, but to the whole economy. Because apart from anything else, they can't afford the welfare costs of massive unemployment. Sorry.
It's okay.
Anyway, so that is a real problem for them. And you're right. They have got to, if you like, create the credit in order to fund the whole caboodle. Now, the Fed has started doing this. It's gone for the reflation rather than controlling inflation, which is going to undermine the purchasing power of the dollar. That is absolutely clear. And I think other governments are going to follow. So, yes, you're absolutely right. And that is what I mean by we're now coming to the end of the fiat currency system. Because we're going to see bond yields rise. The idea of 15.5% bond yields, coupons on long treasuries. In fact, that was a medium dated treasury. It was a 12-year maturity. So
Yeah, that wasn't the 30. We're not
I
even
can
talking
see
about that.
it get, I can see it get up there. And not only that, but if you ask me, but surely, will it stop there? I say, no, I don't think necessarily. The only thing that will stop it is a sort of Volcker-like approach. Jack up the rates as much as necessary and to hell with the consequences. And it requires government to basically back off from its liabilities and say, look, we can't afford it. You guys in the private sector, it's your problem.
Imagine what will happen in France if they do put that if put that
Imagine,
austerity started.
but Andy, imagine it in any nation. I
Of
mean,
course, yeah.
it's just not on now. It really is not. The only nations which really don't have this problem, I think, are China and Russia. Russia's being cut out of it, so she should be quite grateful in a sense, though I don't think that's quite how they look at it. And in China, I think that the level, I mean, the same with Russia, the level of welfare support is actually extremely low. And I think they more readily embrace unemployment or shifts in employment without government intervening. I mean, as I understand it, in China, it's very much a gig economy, and if the jobs aren't there, you just go home and till the fields, sort of thing. It's a bit like that.
Oh, the
But
irony in all of this. Steve, you had a question.
yeah, Alistair, you talked about you would be surprised if the credit bubble didn't pop by this year. And you also talked about, this being the end of the fiat currency. So I guess two questions I have, being a bit more practical, in terms of, I mean, this is big news. And so, like, how do you advise people to prepare? And if this is the end of the fiat currency, how imminent are we talking, and what's next?
Well, I think the answer to this, I'd like to just go into it a little bit because you have to understand the difference between money and credit. John Pierpont Morgan put it well when he said, gold is money and all else is credit. And he's absolutely right. I mean, gold is a form of credit, but the point is there's no counterparty risk. It's embodied in all our common laws that it is actually physical money. That's terribly important. An economy doesn't work on the basis of physical money. It really doesn't. In medieval times, yes, you would probably take payment in coin, and you would look through it, make sure it wasn't clipped. But this doesn't work in a modern economy. A modern economy works entirely on credit. The relationship between money and credit is that money in the form of gold has to secure the value of credit. And if you look at all the charts, of inflation, whatever, wholesale prices, up until the early 1970s, they hardly moved at all. Prices were, they just moved along. I mean, the price of oil, for example, was fixed at something like, I think in 1949, 50, at about $2.56 a barrel. I think it was something like that. It rose once, not hugely, before the Bretton Woods system was suspended by President Nixon. But after that, what happened? I mean, the price of oil exploded, and it's even been up as far as $140 a barrel. I mean, currently it's 60 odd, whatever. It's volatile. It's gone up multiple times. Why? Because the value of credit, which we measure these things in, dollar credit, is no longer tied to real money, which is gold. Now, gold in everybody's common law is real money. It goes back to what the Romans decided was the difference between final settlement and deferred settlement. I'll give you an example. I mean, final settlement is you're paid in gold. Okay, so you buy something and someone pays you in gold. That is final settlement because there's no other counterparty, and that's it. On the other hand, if you, let us say, I don't know, buy something, it doesn't matter what it is, you either write a check or you do a bank transfer. Now, as far as you're concerned, the transaction is completed. But what you've done actually is you've exchanged one credit for another credit. It's the seller of the item which you have just bought is accepting credit, which in the form of an obligation by a bank to discharge that credit to the individual. That credit has moved from you to the person who you bought your goods from. It doesn't get extinguished. This credit continues. The only time it can get extinguished is when that credit is exchanged for physical money, which is gold. So, sorry to go on about it, but this gives you an idea as to exactly how you handle the end of the fiat currency system. The answer is get out of credit and get into gold.
Bargold.
So, silver as well, if you like. What you're doing, you may think you're buying gold, but the best way to look at it is you're selling credit. You're getting out of credit. That's the thing. The purchasing power of gold, okay, it varies, but over millennia, it's pretty constant. And if you run a chart of almost any commodity priced in gold, you see it sort of goes, prices might double, they might halve, but they don't go much beyond that. And a lot of this doubling and halving is because the relationship between gold and dollars, where the whole thing is either manipulated by governments, which has been in the past, or alternatively, we have a system which believes in macroeconomics, which is complete non-science, incidentally, invented by Keynes. And if everybody believes in something, then yeah, they can shift the value of gold measured in fiat currencies, whatever, whatever. And that has been happening. So a lot of the action you see where gold, let us say, has either halved relative to oil or doubled relative to oil has been actually that action has really come out of the fiat currency side rather than the gold side. So this is the key thing. I mean, if you're building a business, you want to invest in that business. You want certainty at the end of that business because you will do your business calculation. What you're trying to calculate is, I'm going to invest in making this product. I know from my experience in this market at what level that product is going to sell. I can then work out my returns. I can also work out the cost of financing it. So I just do the whole thing and I know, boom, 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 and I've got a margin, which is my profit. Okay, now if everything goes right, that's what I'll get. But I do my best because I know what I'm doing in this industry to ensure that I get that. Instead, what's happened is that with declining fiat, the whole thing has got skewed. And what it's done is it's taken, is if you like, devalued people's savings and shifted the whole thing, if you like, in favor of producers. This is a benefit which they don't need, they don't deserve. But what it's done is it's thrown savers onto the mercy of governments for their existence when they retire. Going back to this pension problem. And I mean, in America, I mean, what's the savings rate? I mean, it's a joke.
Yeah, low single
Same in the
digits.
UK. Same in the UK. I mean, Japan is better. China is amazing. I mean, the savings rate, household savings are something like 35% of total income. It's absolutely staggering. And of course, this is one of the things that's fueling demand for gold and silver in China, because housewives are running gold accumulation accounts alongside their deposit accounts in the banks. And as gold goes up, I mean, it's humans, it's you and me. They see it going up and thought, we're going to have a bit of this. And so, I mean, the whole thing, if you like, as far as people like Christine Lagarde at the ECB, as far as they're control, as far as they're concerned, the whole thing is getting out of control. It's making their life extremely difficult. Let's put it
Right.
that way.
Alistair, are you seeing The common people, people like me. Are you seeing the retail people and you? Are you seeing a flight to gold, or is it now still central bank buying or institutional buying that you see that?
Well, it's obviously mainly central bank buying. They're still getting out of fiat currencies, politely put, rebalancing their reserves. I think we're beginning to see institutions, the big institutions, are beginning to move into gold, and I think to a lesser extent, silver. You look at ETF sales. I mean, GLD, suddenly, they're sort of, I think one day last week, that went up 19 tons, and then people who follow these things see it. So you be, we're just beginning to see a little bit of physical demand emanating from the institutions, and I think that will build. We've yet to see very much demand from the general public. This doesn't surprise me, because the general public are the last people to realize that it's not prices going up, but their currency going down.
Right.
Now, the moment they realize that it's their currency going down, that's when they dump it for just to get out of it. They dump it for anything they can buy. Basically, they're selling their currency rather than buying things, if you like. That's the emphasis. So central banks are already doing this with their reserves, getting out of fiat into gold. And that, I think, is gradually spreading down. You've got obviously sovereign wealth funds, who are dealing through their central bank, so that the acquisition of gold bullion by central banks is actually far greater than that recorded, because they're also dealing for sovereign wealth funds, their own sovereign wealth funds, etc. That obviously goes down to funds which are very large and close to government and close to the central banks, the sort of fund managers who can, let's say, have lunch with Jay Powell, or the equivalent in their nation, and get a feel for how things are actually happening on the greatest of macro levels. So they're beginning to go into it. I've got friends in Australia, and I was talking to them this morning, and they're saying that their business actually is beginning to really get very, very busy. I mean, they're dealing in coins and small bars and so on and so forth. So there is, I mean, it's patchy. I was talking to someone in Switzerland who's saying that there's no premium on kilo bars. You'd think,
Interesting.
yeah. He also told me, and this is an interesting one, that you can get Krugerrands at more or less melt, even
Wow.
slightly less. And in reasonable quantity. But I think that's fashion. It's interesting. Krugerrands don't seem to be so fashionable. I mean, we're going for different coins nowadays. So I wouldn't say that that's indicative, if you like, of selling in the markets. Though undoubtedly there have been long-term holders of coins like Krugers, who need funds. I mean, you find that one way and another, people have cash flow problems, and so if they've got some a few old Krugers knocking around in a drawer somewhere,
They're going to
they
sell
come
them.
out. So
Yeah.
I think there could be an element to that. But so it's I think the answer to this, Sandy, is that it hasn't really started yet, but it's just beginning. It's just beginning. And to put it into context, worldwide portfolios are estimated to be around about $300 trillion worth. If you look at the amount of gold that is likely to be in them in the form of physical ETFs, and also maybe to an extent physical gold itself in bar form, you've probably got no more than 0.5% exposure of that 300 trillion in gold.
Right.
And if it's becoming the go-to place in investment terms, which I think is inevitable, then that's going to change very, very substantially. It's going to change the price of gold measured in any fiat currency. And this is one reason why I think we're coming to the end of the fiat currency era, because the other side of an exploding gold price, as in imploding, fiat currency system. That's what we've got.
I think that what you the way you phrased it is very eye-opening, and I think we know that central banks are buying gold, but if you see it from the angle of they're really dumping dollars, it really puts, it makes you see it like, wow, that's a
There
very
is, no, you're absolutely right, Steve. There is another aspect to this which I think is worth considering. I mean, to make a statement that we're coming to the end of the fiat currency system, is you can think, well, okay, that's so what? It's shouldn't we really be worrying terribly about this? But we're talking about the complete collapse of currencies until such time as the governments have the balls to do something about it, to stop it. So what I did was I had a look recently at the situation in Germany following the First World War. So basically to sort of bring you up to date with the history of it, at the outbreak of the First World War, Germany and all the other nations involved just put their gold exchange standards on hold. So this allowed them to fund by expanding debt, by printing money, if you like, rather than going to the population, and taxing them to support the war effort. You do that,
I love your choice of words. 100% correct. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Anyway, so you can see, I mean, it was basically the only way in which you could really finance a big war. So this is what Germany did. The purchasing power of the Reichsmark fell significantly through the course of the war. And in between 1918, when the First World War ended, and 1920, 1918, 1920, it lost significant purchasing power. But then you had a period of stability. Fascinating is fascinating because between about February 1920 and December the 1st, 1921, there was an, I mean, the purchasing power of the mark went up amazingly. Measured against gold, measured against the dollar, it rose very substantially. It was the best performing currency for that brief window of time. Now, this is not
Interesting.
often understood. The stock market crippled. There was a situation. Now, I mean, what I should say is that if you think in terms of today, COVID was like, that was the World War One. Okay. Following that, you had 2 years, roughly. It was roughly 2 years from 2020 to 2022, when suddenly inflation rose. In other words, the purchasing power of our currencies fell in exactly the same way, not to the same extent, admittedly, in exactly the same way as the Reichsmark fell between 1918 and 1920. Then what happens is that we see that inflation goes away. It's sort of the panic when we were looking at inflation rates by calculated by CPI, but actually, in reality, were far higher, sort of, 10, 12%, whatever we briefly hit. And we're now right back down under some sort of control, and it's gone away, and everybody thinks this is fine. Now, what's happening during this time is rather like the German stock market, which crippled. What's you look at the S&P, that's gone up from about 4,500, we're currently 6,700. Same sort of thing. Who's benefiting from this? Exactly the same people, class of people, as benefited in Germany.
The oligarchs.
The ordinary laborer was, he saw no difference at all. Life was still damn hard and all the rest of it. But the middle classes and the people who had actually managed to come out of the war with a little bit of health, wealth were doing actually very well, thank you very much, and they were very happy. But then you had a market crash, which started on the 1st of December, 1920, 20, sorry, 1922. We then went into the third phase, which I would argue actually is looking rather like the end of this fiat currency system. And it was that phase that led to the collapse of the purchasing power of the Reichsmark. And to give you an idea, at the end of that period, one rice, no, one gold mark was exchanged and it was fixed, but you couldn't get the gold mark. There's another mark sort of instead, as it were. It was 1 trillion to one. One
Wow.
trillion to one. Yeah. Before the war, the gold mark was 23 US cents. It was exchangeable at that rate. So the paper mark at the end of it was November 20, 1923, was exchangeable for roughly $1 was the equivalent of 4 trillion marks, paper marks. Now,
Wow.
just think what happens. We're entering into that third phase. You know, it's all very well me coming out the nice glib phrase saying we're seeing the end of the fiat currency system. But that's what it entails, is a complete collapse of purchasing power of fiat currencies. A complete collapse. Only stopped if a government like the Austrian government in 1922 actually did manage to stop it by taking action. But it's going to require, if you like, it's going to require the politicians to have the electoral backing to do it. And that is no mean task. We can talk economics all day, but it's the political will that actually matters. If the politicians actually grasp the nettle and deal with it and feel that they've got the authority to do it, and it will require them to be extremely persuasive of their electorates, then they can, at some stage, rescue their currencies. But it'll be nowhere near current values, nowhere at all. And not only that, but we've got the additional problem that with the fiat currency system, you have macroeconomics. Macroeconomics basically denies human valuations of anything. It's all mechanical, it's all arithmetical, and it's Keynesian.
Yep.
So you have this re-education problem. You know, all those PhDs, you know, being employed at great expense in the Fed and also the US Treasury and all the rest of it, and all the universities, they're going to have to relearn. They're going to have to come down to earth and say, we got it wrong. How long is it going to take for the people who advise governments to actually come up with the right solution?
Yeah.
It's a further hurdle. It really is. The one thing, if you read the history of the German hyperinflation in the early 20s, there were people in government who knew what they had to do to stop the hyperinflation. But the problem was they didn't have the mandate to do it. That's why they didn't stop it. So, you know, who in government today actually understands
Show
what
me,
is.
Alistair.
Yeah, exactly. I can tell you that central bankers do have a pretty good idea. Now,
That's why they're buying gold, right?
they don't have the whole idea. They don't have the whole story. They don't really fully understand the whole thing, but they just know that the thing is going wrong. They can see where it is going wrong, etc. And after all, that's why they're dumping fiat for gold. I mean, and also nations which weren't exposed to our ridiculous Keynesianism and monetarism and all the rest of it, particularly Russia and China, you know,
Wow, that irony.
they don't have this baggage.
Right? Right.
I mean, thank goodness the Chinese actually, you can see what they're doing. They're actually planning for a complete collapse of the dollar. They know it's happening. They know they've got to protect their own currency. They know that it's accelerated under President Trump, which is why, having cornered the gold market, now that's a very important phrase, and it's true, they have cornered the gold market. They are now opening their domestic gold market to foreigners. Foreigners can now deal on the futures exchanges without having to set up a Chinese subsidiary. They're opening vaults in Hong Kong and also in Saudi Arabia. And there will also be gold exchange for yuan facilities in other Southeastern nations. That is all. We know this is now happening. But when you put it all together, you can see that at some stage, President Xi can just go, oh, right, that's the rate we're going to fix the yuan.
Yeah.
And it's like a sort of Bretton Woods Mark II. You know, you and I can't go along with our grubby bits of yuan paper and say to a friendly Chinese bank, I want to exchange this for gold, please, at the official rate. No, that's not going to happen. But governments in their international trades, settling their trade balances, will be able to use gold-backed yuan. That is the key. So
Wow.
while we're going to hell in a handcart, the Asian hegemons, along with the whole of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, all of BRICS, and the Global South, who want to be in on this game because they realize, you know, they don't like us, or they realize that, you know, we're not people to be associated with. They will all basically be moving on to, effectively, a gold standard. I mean, it'll be de facto rather than de jure, as it were. But you can see that 70% of the world's population is going to enjoy, if you like, a new industrial revolution based on sound money, while we're just falling apart.
Yeah, that actually gives me some hope. If we don't get it, at least they do.
Absolutely.
That gives me some hope. Alistair, we've taken way too much of your time. I just want to publicly thank you so much. You're so gracious to me in spending time with me. Can you get, I know you're on Substack. Can you give your Substack so if people want to read your information, if people want to reach out to you, how do they go about doing that?
You can either do it via my website, which is mcleodfinance.com, or alternatively, it's alistairmcleod.substack.com. Either takes you to my Substack. And my mission basically is to try and educate people about what's going on so they can protect themselves and their families and also their communities, because this is not going to be pleasant. Someone in your circle has got to take the lead on this and ensure that you protect yourselves. That's the way it is, and I want to educate people so they can understand what they have to do.
Well done. You have done that. I'll put all of this in the show notes below on this, as well as Apple and Spotify. I want to thank you so much for your time, Alistair. Look forward to having you on again really soon.
Very much my pleasure. Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks, Alistair.